Chat.
All right, you're now tuned in to the 13th episode of Taking It Down. Taking It Down is the Alabama Takes Pop Culture Discussion podcast, and I'm the host, Blaine Duncan. Welcome. Glad you joined us. Grab some coffee, get settled in. We're releasing a day earlier than usual to beat the Christmas rush. So if you're a regular listener, that's why we're coming to you on a Monday, assuming the podcast aggregators got it to you in time. I'm sure they have their own holiday stuff to go through. So normally we hit the airwaves and podcast feeds every other Tuesday, but we wanted to give you an opportunity to listen before you have to put up with your families on Christmas, or maybe use us to avoid having to interact with any of them, because there's only so many times you can listen to that 55-year-old Carpenter's Christmas album. So for this one, we got our old pal and co-host Adam Morrow here. We're going to wrap up our talk on what's been the best of the decade. If you missed it in a podcast before this one, he and I covered what we thought were the most monumental in movies. And then two episodes previous to this one, we did the same treatment for television over the past 10 years. So today we're going to talk about the best in music. We'll touch on books a little bit toward the end of that segment. Then in the back half of the podcast today, Adam and I, we're going to talk about the lingering finale of that HBO series Watchmen. Stay tuned for that. But go ahead and warn you, we're doing full-on spoilers because we're pretty much only talking about that last episode. So get caught up before you listen to that. That's on the back half of the pod. Oh, and a quick note, in each of our podcast information that you can find online when you read what the podcast is about, both on the website and the descriptions in the provider, we have a little timestamp plugged in there for the segment, so you can come back and listen to it if you haven't caught up on whatever it is we're watching. You can check that timestamp so you don't get spoiled on anything, or if it just doesn't interest you, you can skip that segment. So that's just a little note. I don't know if I've ever made clear to anyone. Okay, and as always, there's a bit more at the website, a lot this week and next week. Articles, thoughts, musings on all sorts of cultural happenings. We've got a lot of year-end stuff going on. Top 10 lists already out for good old top 10 season, including top 10 shows of the year. And the worst shows of the year are up. Plenty of other year-end stuff coming down the pipe. So check out the website, thealabamatake.com. But that was a really long intro. Let's dive into it, though. Let's get going. Here we are with Taking It Down. All right, here he is, Mr. Adam Morrow.
Good to be here. Got my third cup of the coffee. I'm ready.
I was going to say, you're rejoicing in the splendor of Christmas, or as you like to call it, Xmas. I think you're...
Xmas. Well, I'm a little weary. The third cup of coffee, the war on Christmas has been... Mm. We've been fighting hard this year, so...
Yeah. How's it going?
Oh, I mean, you know, you've been there in the trenches.
Yeah.
I think it's going pretty well.
You and I are not going to talk Star Wars stuff to the consternation or dismay or relief of the audience. You haven't seen it, right?
So we haven't gone yet. Okay. There's the promise of a family movie outing with the in-laws. So we're saving it for the hometown visit.
Okay. So no Star Wars for you. Me either. I haven't seen it. So, but
do you feel a rush to go? I mean, you've made it through the first weekend without going.
Yeah, I actually feel more now. So we record on Sunday, and I feel the rush to go today more than ever, because I suppose the embargo on spoilers are starting to be lifted, because I've seen some headlines that hint toward things, and I'm like, no, you didn't have to put that in the headline,
right,
people.
Right.
Because I know better than to click on anything before I've seen it. I'm not that stupid, but...
I've made it through the weekend spoiler-free, so we'll see if I can make it to the holidays.
Yeah, I saw something that was... I'm not sure how revealing it'll be. I guess I'll find out tomorrow when I go. So anyway, no Star Wars this week. I don't know if we'll come back to it or not. It's probably a pretty saturated market for Star Wars.
So we probably so.
Yeah. But anyway, you and I are here to talk, first of all, about the music of the past decade, maybe even touch on a few books towards the end of this part of our conversation. But before we get too deep into it, I just want to ask, I'm going to clear the air here. Are any of your is your list just Kanye's discography? Is that what?
Yeah, Kanye and any record that I played on is all I'm going to talk about for the next 45
okay.
minutes.
So, okay, cool.
Yeah, damn. Pretty much Yeezus and myself.
Well, let's get started. So, let's dive in. Music. What do you have on You said you had a lot of thoughts on this decade of music. What do you, you want to give general thoughts first and then maybe break down a few albums?
Well, like with all the other, I guess because music is probably what I consume the most of, out of the four topics that we're going to hit on this decade in list. And so I feel like I really have seen shifts happen. You know, like if you think about what was big at the beginning, 2010, and what is happening now, just like everything else, you know, the patterns start to emerge, you know, from point A to point B. And it's been a pretty interesting time. Like there's artists on my list that just made consistently great stuff. There's people who had comebacks, people who kind of like went away for a while. Yeah, it's kind of all over the place.
What trend, did you see an overarching trend when you started looking at your list?
I think there's a few. I think one that started with a lot of promise and kind of has gotten to the point where I hate this word is Americana. Like there's a lot of records from the early part of this decade that I enjoyed a good bit. And now I kind of just recoil at that idea, you know? So, and then I think the conventional pop record probably made either of our lists, but it is interesting to see like I did put Yeezus on my list, the Kanye record, and to see, I guess that style of, it sounded so brutal and minimalist at the time. And now like all of pop music kind of went through that phase. And now it's almost like some of the bedroom pop, like in the indie world, indie pop from the beginning of the decade now has kind of crept into the mainstream, like with the Billie Eilish stuff, that whole style of music. I don't know. There's a lot of roads to walk down here.
Okay. Well, I only have a few and I'll chime in here and there, but go ahead and give us some of your defining or best or favorite albums of this past decade.
I mean, I definitely live in the, there's no organization to my list here, but I definitely live in the indie rock, indie pop kind of world. So let's see, where do we want to start? I think maybe one that we have in common, and this is a band that there's a few of these that really their career has mostly been in this decade. And so to watch them go from promising to releasing what I think are masterpieces has been really fun. And the number one on that list for me is The War on Drugs.
Yeah, they're definitely on mine. So I really only wanted them to have one on my list. Mine's probably a little shorter than yours. Which album did you end up going with of theirs that was this decade?
See, that's... all of it is so tied. If I had to pick one to listen to...
Yeah.
It's a toss-up between Lost in the Dream and A Deeper Understanding to me. Yeah. I think A Deeper Understanding is probably the better record, but... Lost in the Dream. So they put out Slave Ambient in 2011. Mm-hmm. I thought this is a really cool record. And then Lost in the Dream came out. And it's like, okay, they are the best at this thing that they are doing. And then it kind of furthered that idea on A Deeper Understanding to me.
Slave Ambient to me took a few too many side roads to get to the music, I think, at times. And they do that in Lost in the Dream, but just enough to make it a part of the melody. It's I picked Lost in the Dream, by the way. I think I like it just a little better than their most recent album. And I'm so looking forward to anything they've put out. They've got me hooked for sure. They may be my favorite band. I wrote about them, I guess it was this year or last year on the site. Mm-hmm. They're one of my favorites for hands down, but maybe the favorite band I've got going as far as a band goes. Perfect example of how to incorporate a bit of what some people would call sort of jamminess or spaciness without losing the listener, I think.
Right. And there may be an interesting, that word jammy, you know, I feel like if you zoom back to 2010, 2011, indie rock bands talking about, say, the Grateful Dead, in a tone of respect, and like that was a band that they loved, that never happened. And then you had a lot of, strangely enough, it seemed like guitar music is constantly dying. You know, that's what everybody always says. And then you have guys like The War on Drugs come out and just it's all about big guitar solos and big moments. And even bands like The National put together that Day of the Dead thing and kind of made all of that okay to like, you know, that's an interesting kind of small side trend. And we're talking about decade trends.
Yeah, that album was like this huge compilation of covers of the Grateful Dead by mainly indie rock musicians.
I could probably just use the list of bands who played on that, and that would be a pretty solid decade in list. I mean, it really kind of had everybody.
Yeah, it did. Who else you got?
Well, I'll change the theme a little bit. I think a band that put out their first great record in 2010 and then just kept making great records and getting better at being themselves instead of reinventing is Beach House.
Hmm.
They put out four of my favorite records from this decade, and I if I had to pick, I may pick 2012 Bloom is the name of the record, but they're all phenomenal.
They've got that cool, gentle indie rock sound is what I associate with them, though they may have branched out from what I've heard.
Very dream pop kind of synth driven stuff, which is definitely a theme on this list that I have going. And I think you can even draw a through line from them to a band like Always.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And they were one of my favorite bands of the decade too. Always spelled with two V's, right?
Always.
Yeah, that's the way I want to say it, but it is pronounced Always. So yeah.
Yeah. I think any Socialites that came out in 2017 is, I didn't make a top five, but this would definitely be in the top part of the top five.
That first album of theirs just blew me away. I didn't even know it was on the map, and I happened to see it in a year-end list. So, you know, those of you who hate year-end lists, I find them helpful.
They come in handy.
Yeah, so I found that first album of theirs, their first full-length, and it blew me away. It's just amazing how tight and poppy and, but yet introspective and fun. And, well, those two things didn't quite go together. Introspective yet fun. I don't know. Amazing band there.
Yeah. That sums it up for me. It was like hearing, like, how did this not already exist? You know what I mean? It kind of has that timeless quality to it. And I think the one definitive, I'm going to plant my flag and say this was the best thing that I'm going to do out of any of these lists.
Okay.
Marry Me, Archie is the best song of the decade.
No disagreement here, I don't think. I can't think of anything.
I think that is a perfect guitar pop song.
I've got another one that I'll bring up later that could rival that song as far as the best song of the decade. I'll bring it up later.
Well, let's pivot to that. Do you think that is now the time? Or are we going to...
Let's do it then. Okay. So, we're not on any kind of chronological structure. So, one of the albums I was going to mention is 2017's Youth Detention. And I know there's I carry with me a certain bias probably, but I think that album is really great. And I think that it's got one of maybe the best song of the decade on there, which is Nail My Feet Down to the South Side of Town, which is just emotionally resonant musically, harmoniously. If you just play me the music to that song, it still has a certain effect on me. And of course, that you played with that band, so
I left them off the list for that reason, hoping that maybe we, you know, hint at it or kind of talk about it, because I always struggle to contextualize local being a very broad term, I guess, like regional stuff that has national importance. I mean, people around the world listen to these records. But like when you know Lee and you know Adam and Blake, it's just kind of like, you know, that those songs mean so much to me, and I loved playing them this year. And I agree that's the standout track to me. But it's always kind of tough to, like, I don't know, contextualize. It's hyper regional, but I mean, on that tour, people sang along to it all across the country. You know what I mean? Like, that was a high point every night. So clearly, it's not just our regional or friend based bias. I think that's just an incredible song.
That whole album's just it's really great, and it's just a socially conscious look. To me, I interpret it as it being a socially conscious look of how youth can be manipulated, but also can be much more free than other phases of life. That's how I've always taken that album. And then that's one of the best examples of that song, though plenty of other great songs on that album. So that I would argue that maybe Marry Me, Archie and Nail My Feet Down are the two best songs of the decade.
I could go with that.
Yeah.
I'm in.
And I'll admit, there's two things I need to probably should have said at the top is that this is the decade where music lost me. It happens to every generation where you know, my dad didn't understand what I was listening to, and I'm sure his dad didn't either, and so on. I think this is where, when I started keeping up with some of the music, when I could keep up with some of the music that younger people were listening to, I didn't quite latch on to it anymore.
You didn't get it.
Sometimes.
You don't get it, man.
I can recognize, in some cases, I can recognize that it's good. It's just not for me.
Right.
Billie Eilish is a good example. Like I hear it and I think that's pretty good, but I never listened to it. So I never returned to it.
Right. That was kind of why I didn't include pop stuff. I feel like that's a different conversation where I'll hear something and think, yeah, that's fine. Mm-hmm. That even is good, but I'm never compelled to pull it up on my Spotify or anything like that.
So Beyonce didn't make your list. Because you're a big Beyonce fan.
I definitely will defend Beyonce in these conversations, for sure. I think maybe one of the coolest musical, I don't know if artifact is the right word. I don't know how to really describe the her Coachella performance.
Oh, yeah.
Which ended up as a Netflix special. I think that was one of the greatest musical things, but it wasn't a record and it wasn't really a single, or maybe that's why it's so interesting, is because it is a very 2010s thing, you know, Beyonce partnering with this festival that just massively exploded in the last 10 years, even bigger than it already was, to put something out on Netflix, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much more 2010s can you get than...
That's it. That is pop culture in one thing. But the way that she... When she did Lemonade, mm-hmm. I guess for a pop star to look around and try to say something culturally, you know, to include, say, like musicians from historically black universities, mm-hmm. To include all these pretty, you know, she could just live a very wealthy New York life and forget about the fact that her family's from the South, she grew up in Houston, that she has all these connections to, and just be privileged. You know what I mean? How many pop stars do you see just kind of like put out fun songs? And the fact that she didn't do that, and she still is like maintaining her image perfectly. And I'm not saying she's like down in the struggle, so to speak, but
she's not in the muck.
No, definitely not. But still, she provided some great moments. I couldn't pinpoint a record and say like, this is a thing that I really enjoyed, but she definitely, if it was, you know, performing on an award show or that Netflix special, there's a lot of great musical moments, I thought, that were provided by old Beyonce.
So no Beyonce, but you did have Kanye's on your list, the Yeezus record, and not any of these other ones. Tell me more about that.
I think Yeezus was, like, I even thought that Watch the Throne that he did with Jay-Z was pretty fun. That's 2011. Yeah. I wouldn't put it on this list, but it was maybe if you're talking about what changed between the beginning of this decade and now, it's beyond just two dudes, do they like each other or not, or the weird path that Kanye has taken. That was just like fun, kind of the whole thing was like a prideful boast about two of the most powerful guys in music getting together, and it was fun, and you know, but then Yeezus is this very, I say what you will about Kanye during that period, he was pulling in some pretty weird influences, I guess. And this comes across as very, it's kind of brutalist in a way. It's minimalist at times. The synths are like very textured and the beats are kind of angular. And I don't know. The whole thing was, Yeah, I remember putting that on, and maybe I don't know how many listeners will. I remember listening to that record for the first time and putting it on in the car, driving to a Looker show, actually, with Josh Kavanaugh. We went down to, I guess, Mobile, maybe.
Okay.
And just him hating it so much and me listening to it over and over again. So that fond memories of Yeezus, and I think it kind of holds up more than any other Kanye record from this decade.
It holds up in that you're still irritate Josh Kavanaugh?
Oh, both ways. Yeah, it's a great record, and it would definitely still piss him off. So,
what's the best track off that album to you? What's your favorite?
I'm going to have to pull up the list because I'm going to forget something on that. From the time that it comes, Bound 2 is definitely the best, like, one song. You know, that kind of has, like, its melodies and it's palatable in a pop way. Like, if I was only going to listen to one, I would probably pull that up. But even the first song on site, it works as a record, you know, from point A to point B. That weird textured synth comes in, and then the beats come in, and you know, this was still the same guy that said George Bush doesn't like black people. The track Blood on the Leaves, using that sample, mixing it in and out, he still had something to say, whereas now he just has something to sell, it seems like. I mean, he was always selling something, but I think this is his last great record.
Man, slamming Kanye on the pod today. He's gone from who had something to say to something to sell.
Got him.
Put that on the t-shirt.
Yeah, just put that all over Twitter and we'll see how it goes.
Well, some people would probably agree with you.
Yeah.
What else are we seeing in music in this decade, this past decade?
We'll change it up. I'm thinking about that. Beyonce at Coachella, another band that I associate with that big festival thing that really blossomed this decade, is Tame Impala.
They're on my list too.
We just texted about this. You said, has anyone had a more rapid decline after a record than Tame Impala after Lonerism?
That's my statement.
I would put all three of these records as pretty good. Interspeak, Lonerism, and Currents. I thought Currents was, it's super poppy and kind of borderline cheesy, but I dug it. You didn't like it?
No. I think everything after Lonerism sounded like a band, especially their newest album, I guess, was this year. It sounds like a completely different band in a bad way. It sounds like they've quit taking risks and are instead trying to play in a pop format, which is fine, but after you listen to that opening track on Lonerism and hear so much going on and some risk happening, not trying to appease any kind of top 40 sound, I don't know. I'm just disappointed because now I hear them and I still want to be into them because I'll recognize the name and I'll think, oh, this song's probably going to be good, or this release may be good, and I hear it and I just think, no, it's just not for me anymore.
Yeah. I think they're probably going to lose me on the next record. But looking back on this decade, I think Currents was still an achievement. They set out to do the pop thing, and it's very smooth, it's very sleek, but I still liked it. But I'm with you, Lonerism is the one. And I would even put that the song Feels Like We Only Go Backwards. That's definitely in a top 10 song of the decade for me conversation. Mm,
it's a good one, yeah. I've got two obvious ones probably for me. If you know me, these are going to be really obvious. Two guys I thought put out some good music. I thought Springsteen's Wrecking Ball was really good, and I know a lot of people disagree with me on that. And I thought Dylan's, these are the same year, by the way, Bob Dylan's The Tempest, 2012, was Dylan's best album of the decade and easily one of the best that he's done since Time Out of Mind.
Is that your modern era Dylan before and after Time Out of Mind?
Yeah, it's got to be. That's the defining point for him, that 1997 Time Out of Mind record. The Tempest to me was almost as good as that. There were some really good, and it was very thematic, something you don't get a lot of from albums in this day and time, but there was a lot of violence on that album. If you go back and listen to how many times he talks about murder or killing, it's interesting to hear a guy in his late 70s to to examine, you know, so much brutality.
That is an interesting phenomenon, I guess, of these, both those guys. Dylan's obviously older, I guess, classic rock stars, mm-hmm. and not classic rock like the radio format, but classic mm-hmm. rock stars entering the old later school phases.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Entering the later phases of life, and the ones that are able to do it, their heads still up and their eyes still open, makes for some really interesting music for the last 10 years.
Since 2012, Dylan's just done the Sinatra-esque cover albums. He's done three of those albums since then, which is an incredibly odd turn to do three. Maybe somebody could have predicted that he would do one, but to do three is really out there.
I could not have predicted either of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. But with Springsteen on Wrecking Ball, I thought that he captured the disgruntled nature of that end of the recession era, and everybody's improving, but this select group of people who aren't. And I think he captured that on an album quite well, as he's prone to do. I also saw him on that tour. So,
oh, really? Where'd you see him?
In Atlanta. Okay. It was April of that year. It was April of 2013, I guess it was. So it was a good show. And I really just like Wrecking Ball. He does some things a little differently there. He brought in Tom Morello on a couple of tracks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, and then he toured with him for a pretty good spell.
Yes, he did. Which Tom Morello wasn't in on the Atlanta show that I saw, but it was great.
Springsteen is also, we mentioned the Beyonce Netflix thing. Mm-hmm. If I had to pick a Springsteen thing, it would be his Broadway show.
Gosh, yes. So good.
So good. And talking about that later career decision to do something that you wouldn't expect. You know, the thing with the Broadway show, and this has been talked about quite a bit, so we'll, I guess, keep moving after this, but you know, he had to do the same thing every night. That's mm-hmm. remarkable to me for a rock mm-hmm. star who's used to kind of freewheeling through a 3-hour set. Like when Tom Morello played with him, he said he got a list of about 100 songs to learn, and who knows what they're going to play every night.
Gosh,
you know, even if there is a set list, he may change it. You may be, you know, on your fifth show of a single week, and he's gonna like all. Every set list is different, and he may just pick, like, you know, the 98th song on that list that you never expected to play, and it's going to be there that night. So you got to be ready for that kind of guy to do that residency on Broadway and do the same thing every night. I didn't see it in person. Everybody I know who did said it was like life-changingly good.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But the Netflix special I thought was great. And they all also said when that came out, they said that captures it. You know, you can never capture being in the room when something that special is happening, but it captured it pretty well. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
He, what I found special about that was that he put so much effort into it, because it is a one-man musical, you know.
Right.
It's not just a show.
No, he's not just going out and playing. It's the monologues bleed into the songs, which is fitting for him, I guess. Once he did it, it's like, yeah, this makes sense, but maybe not something that I would have expected.
You're right.
I think the other guy that I would put into this interesting phase of the career conversation, I thought Leonard Cohen put out some great records.
Okay.
In the last decade. I think both the last one and was it Popular Problems, is that the name of the one that came before it? I thought they were both really good. I don't know that I would like single any out, but just since we're on that topic of people doing things, staying interesting later on in their career, I mean, kind of like Bowie, you know, he knew that the end was nigh and made great art staring at it.
Leonard Cohen is at the very top. He's number one on my list of people I should listen to more. And I love so much of what he does. And whenever I hear him on the radio or by chance, I just think to myself, why do I not listen to all of his stuff?
He's been doing it since the 60s. You know, there's a lot to dig through, and it's fairly dense. But yeah, those two records in particular, Popular Problems and You Want It Darker, that's good stuff.
Those are good picks. I'm glad you brought those up. What else you got?
Let's go to the opposite end of the spectrum. We were talking about the old guys. a band that started in 2015 and for my money is channeling art and creativity and the true nature of a band in the democratic sense, all for one for all kind of thing. Big Thief.
I thought that's where you were going with this. Yeah.
I think they are all, or at least I know the main songwriter, Adrian Linker. She is not even 30 years old, and I think they have put out some true gems. The first record, Masterpiece, I thought was really good. I thought Capacity, the one after that, was really good. And then they put out two records this year.
Two this year, that's right. I was going to point that out. They're hardworking.
Yeah, and they are. I think that it's so rare that bands exist. I mean, this has always been true. I don't know if it's more true now, as maybe we're more individualist than we ever have been as a culture. Everybody can kind of go down their wormhole. And especially when you're making music, you can sit in your bedroom and make a fully realized record if you're good enough and then just upload it and it's your thing. These are four people who they're all pillars of that band. You know, she's an incredible songwriter and gets the credit maybe more often. But yeah, I find that very encouraging.
I didn't know that about them. How did you figure that out? Or did you just read about them a few times and found out that they're very reliant on one another?
Well, their origin story is that Adrian and the guitar player, Buck Meek, traveled together in a van and did like a duo thing for a long time and ended up recruiting these two other guys to play with them. So already it kind of has that, like, you know, they had kind of been through it before.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I saw them in 2017 in Birmingham, and there were probably 15 other people there. And it was an incredible show, and they had just played NPR's big stage at South By and like had an incredible, that's kind of the barometer for a young band is like, how busy are you at South by Southwest? And are you playing kind of these marquee shows? And they had just done that the week before. I mean, it was like a Tuesday night, just days afterwards in Birmingham. There's not that many people there and the sound is just okay. And I know the load in, you have to carry all your stuff up these rickety stairs. But they were still just incredible. So they played a great show. And so I saw them that night and they were very genuine. And, you know, I mean, she sold me their record with her Square reader on her phone. And as they got bigger and bigger that year, I ran into them again at a festival in Canada and like watched them. It was this odd, Winnipeg Folk Festival. You stay in Winnipeg and have to take a bus out to the festival grounds. It's like out on a national park kind of thing. So all of the artists get on these buses that are running constantly, the shuttle service, and kind of sit there together for an hour, you know? And so you kind of just start talking to people or kind of observing how other bands work, and they move as a unit. Everything that's been written about them is absolutely true. I just came away very impressed, and then they rattled off a lot of great music since then.
Yeah, for sure.
Not to turn that into a, here's my experience playing this festival with a band that I really like, but
I find that stuff really insightful and interesting. So I'm going to give a shout out to an artist I don't think a lot of people even know about anymore. 2015, the artist named Hayden released Hey Love, that album. Not Hayden Crawford.
I don't listen to him.
No, shit, no. Nah. So this is Hayden, and that's all he goes by. And anyway, Hey Love in 2015, the summer of 2015. It's a good one. It's just perfect from start to finish, and there's a tone of loneliness that embraces this album, or maybe that he embraced in making the album. It's nothing extravagant. It's just a beautiful piece of work, I think. He's still putting out great music. I know there might be a few of our listeners who know him from 94, maybe. I'm going to guess at that. About 94, he kind of had a small hit on the 120 minutes show of MTV. He's a very deep, deep baritone type singer, and really emphasized it. I think that that song he had in the 90s that was a little big was probably the guitar was dropped a whole step, I think, or maybe even.
Okay. You can hear the strings flopping around a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Look that up if you haven't, although that's not of this decade, but that's probably your entryway into his music. But Hey Love was one of my favorite albums of the year. What else you got?
I'll pick another one from that year.
Sure.
And talking about introspective, Courtney Barnett's first full length.
Oh, yeah. Really good.
Sometimes I sit and think, sometimes I just sit. I think that is, she had such a casual, has, her new stuff is great too, but to me, this is the one, just a casual way of writing and delivering really insightful lyrics. I don't know of another songwriter that came close this decade to what that specific thing that she achieved there. Think tracks like Depreston. I mean, mm-hmm. Just such good stuff.
Yeah, that's a really good song. One of my favorite songs by her. She is linked to Kurt Vile quite a bit too, whom I got into this decade. If you're not careful with Kurt Vile, you'll think that he's kind of making the same album over and over, but mm-hmm. there are nuances in it. He certainly has a style, which is comforting in music. Sometimes you want to go to a certain artist because of their style, and I think that he's done that. But he's pretty good too. Any of the albums he's released, especially the most recent one, I think the most recent one he released this year, last year, was top notch. Maybe one of his best.
So he's one that I enjoy when I hear and have even listened to some of those records, but I'm not sure that I could pick one out and say like, this was a great thing that I kept going back to.
Yeah.
You know, they did that record together, which I thought was pretty interesting. But even on mm-hmm. that, I found myself way more drawn to Courtney Barnett's songs.
Yeah. I get that. She's good. Quality. Left-handed guitar player.
She can shred too.
That's right.
I mean, just shred that Telecaster.
All right, anything we haven't talked about that you really want to squeeze in here?
The nice, safe indie rock. Real Estate put two records out this mm-hmm. decade that I really, really, I enjoyed all their records. I'm a total sucker for interlocking jangle pop. So I think probably their strongest entry is their second overall record, Days, that came out in 2011. Has songs like Green Isles, which, if you're trying to do that certain brand of guitar dream poppy kind of jangle stuff, I'm not sure it gets much better than that one.
Okay. Good recommendation. I like that one.
I think another band, if you talk about charting progress from Kernels of Promise at the beginning to mm-hmm. a full-fledged thing by the end, His Golden Messenger definitely fits that bill. Another really prolific. It's a band, but it also, like, kind of comparing and contrasting with Big Thief, he's kind of created, MC Taylor, this community of musicians centered around Durham, North Carolina, that triangle area that has produced so much good music, you know, Home of Merge, all that stuff. Folks like Phil Cook kind of go in and out of the band. So that whole world that he's created, I'm a big fan of as it developed this decade. I think his 2016 record, Heart Like a Levee, I think that's probably my pick from the His Golden Messenger discography.
I think this is where you and I diverge. I just never could find an entryway into his music. I couldn't. Nothing latched on to me, or I didn't latch on to much of what he was doing, and I don't know why. So
yeah. Well, some hit, some don't.
There you go.
It's fine. Yeah.
The one that we haven't talked about, I think, that was the... I'll drop two, and I won't talk about them a lot, is Damien Gerard of St. Bartlett from 2010.
Yeah.
I guess it barely gets in. Man, I love that album so much. And I also really liked Bright Eyes, the Connor Oberst, I guess you could, but he released it as the Bright Eyes band, The People's Key from 2011.
Yeah, that was a fun record. That's a strange word maybe to describe a Bright Eyes record, but yeah.
I think that's the moment where Oberst really gets away from, I know some people associate him with a bit of whiny flavor. Mm-hmm. I think he gets away from that hugely, and that wine kind of peppers some of his earlier releases, but there's a certain maturity to this lyrics, and it's less juvenile.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really a thematic work. I think that's pretty good.
Well, and talk about another person who has created, it may not even always bear his name, but like a whole world around himself. You know, he's stayed moving this decade.
Yes. Yeah.
A lot of different bands. You know, doesn't he do stuff with Phoebe Bridgers now?
Better Oblivion Community Center, which is a fantastic album.
Good stuff. The other, you got me thinking about the Damian Gerardo, Brothers and Sisters of the Eternal Sun. I think that's a really, really cool record.
Yeah.
Produced by Richard Swift, who produced a ton of stuff and had his own solo stuff that I really enjoyed this record or this decade. One of the losses of the decade as well. Mm-hmm. A tragic end there, but it's incredible work.
All right. Did we rattle them all off? Did we, think you covered the decade well?
I do. There's like still so much to say, I guess. For me, music has been such a big part of it. And I can kind of, that's the beauty of music. You know, you kind of chart life experiences by what the soundtrack was.
Yeah, you really did.
And it was an intense decade of that for me, getting to start to do it as a job. So those records that soundtracked van rides and all that kind of thing I thought it was a great 10 years of music.
Although it did get away from me a little, the new stuff. Books are harder. We're going to transition into books here. Books are harder because you may not read them until 5 years later. So
right. Books are really tough. This is by far the hardest one. I'm just going to get a reading list from you basically on this section.
Well, I only have a few, primarily because each year I usually read about two or three that were actually released that year, and then I'm playing catch up the rest of the year on what I read. And I read maybe 12, 13 books a year. And so only a few of them are from that year. But I did start looking back over what I'd read. I use Goodreads, and it definitely helps on seeing what I've read and what I thought. And some of these you've read, I think.
I definitely have, because I pillage your Goodreads. It's great.
but I'll just go in chronological order and rattle off a few. So the first one I would talk about is The Age of Miracles by Kieran Thompson Walker. And it's a moving, affecting look at coming of age, but the coming of age is a genre unto itself, but she does something different. She uses the lens of a high concept narrative, a very obvious metaphor, but it's just so wonderfully gentle with its teenage character. The metaphor, it's on page one. It's on the back of the book, so I'm not spoiling anything, but the metaphor is that the world is starting to slow its turn on its axis, which causes lots of problems and that are almost sci-fi, but also seemingly realistic. So that's a great one, I thought. She also released another one, I think it was this year, which was stellar too. It's called The Dreamers. That's also worth reading. And chime in here if there's something I mentioned that you...
I'm literally pulling up extra tabs and opening Wikipedia pages so I know to catch up here.
The next one is from the same year, and this may be the book of the decade for me. It's The Fates Will Find Their Way by Hannah Pittard.
That's a great one. I did read that one.
That one you did read. I remember I was talking about it a few years ago. And maybe my favorite book ever, not just of the decade. It's
for those ever.
Wow. Yeah, it's perfect in it's perfect in its tone. It's perfect in its distance. It keeps the reader, and it just makes you want to continue to try to get closer. But you, I don't know that you really do. It's about the effect of a 16-year-old girl who disappears on Halloween, and it being on Halloween, I think might have a lot of effect on me too. I know a lot of people weren't crazy about it, but I just found it ghostly and haunting, but never scary. It's not a scary novel. It's not
right.
Horror.
I agree. And this is a theme I immediately thought of a song that we have both bonded over and didn't mention in the decade wrap up that ties in a lot of the things that we both seem to enjoy have that kind of haunted quality that you're talking about. It's not scary. It's just, it has a vibe, and it's usually kind of has to do with a adolescent coming of age. That's a good trope to use, but Teenage Wasteland by Wussy.
Okay.
These things go hand in hand to me.
Yeah, they do. And that's a really good song. That was that released this decade?
2014.
Oh, wow. It's a shame I didn't mention it. I assumed it was before because I didn't discover that song until about 3 or 4 years ago. So I was behind on finding it. That's why I assumed it was older than that. Yeah.
This talking about the Fates Will Find Their Way kind of jogged my memory on that. But
yeah, so you've read that one.
I have, yeah. I thought it was great.
It's weird because if you look on reviews and Goodreads, if you go by their mishmash of reviews, you know, they have a rating. It's not a very high rated book. And if you glance at reviews, it's not hailed as a masterpiece or anything. It gets pretty good reviews in some instances, but I don't know. It had an effect on me is all I can say, which is, it's about all you really want out of a book, I suppose. The next book definitely has the quality that you're talking about of that haunted yet centered in youth quality. It's All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr or Doerr.
That's one I never read that one. I saw the cover prominently displayed at many fine bookstores, but you know, fill me in. What's the deal?
It was prominent for a while in the year that it was released, and for good reason. It's World War II. There is a young French girl and a young German guy, and it could have been your boilerplate World War II drama, but it's just so eloquent and musical, I would say. Mm. And I thoroughly recommend it. I don't want to say much because if it's about those two, obviously they're going to intertwine at some point.
Right.
But that's about all I'll tell you.
Well, I'm in on the premise. That was a pretty sizable book, right?
I can't believe you said that. I was just about to say, it looks daunting, but if you start flipping through it, like there are some chapters that are barely a page.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then there's, you know, there are, the author does these things where he divides up segments of the book, and those divisions are, take up a page themselves. So it's okay. Not as like, it was a very quick read for me. And really hard to put down as well. The classic hard to put down trope though. And I'll give you two more. And these next two are both from 2018 and they're both nonfiction pieces. And the first is The Electric Woman, a memoir in death defying acts by Tessa Fontaine, and such a emotional book, which, the author Fontaine, who went to the University of Alabama, actually, she deals with her mother's, these repeated strokes that her mother keeps having.
Mm.
I wouldn't say deals. That's really not a fair statement. But she sort of, while her mother is going through these health problems, she also joins a sideshow, one of the last sideshows in America. And so it's this examination of how we deal with hardships, and it's a pretty moving piece of writing that I would recommend to almost anyone. It's pretty good. And the last one I've got on tap is I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which was the Michelle McNamara's book that she did not finish because of her untimely death. She was Patton Oswalt's wife.
Mm-hmm.
So she, it may be the best true crime book that I've ever read. It overcomes so many cliches and overcooked things you usually find in any kind of true crime. And I don't read a ton of true crime, but I've read occasionally. But it wasn't finished before she died, and that might have caused it to lose a little momentum. But I think a lot of people did enjoy it. And that killer was actually caught 8 months later after the book's release. So
wow,
I blew my mind that they found the actual Golden State Killer, as he was called.
Right,
and it's certainly scary. And she intertwines her own personal life of staying up late to do the research, And it's a fast read, too. Very good one. And that's what I've got for the books of the decade. Did you have any that you wanted to add that I didn't get around to?
I will throw in two nonfiction to piggyback off those. Just Kids, the Patti Smith book, came out just right at the dawn of the decade, January of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everything that she's written since then, her voice is amazing. Even her Instagram presence. Who would guess that Patti Smith would be great at Instagram?
Really?
Yeah. Great follow.
Didn't even know she had one.
She's a great follow. Very uplifting, very just that typical finding artistic wonder in everyday things. But in it, I guess I mentioned that because this book has so much of that, and it feels like, kind of a coming-of-age tale and a portrait of two artists before anybody, you know, gave a shit about who they were.
And it's a real New York book, right?
Very New York book, and very her telling stories about her life, like we all could, about that period of being in our early 20s. Hers just happened to be at like the nexus of culture, you know? So it's everything from like Jimi Hendrix to the dawn of bands like Television and the whole CBGB thing. And it's great. And then the other nonfiction book that comes to mind is one that I finally just read this year, The Shepherd's Life by James Rebanks. And this is kind of maybe a left field choice, but it's about a guy who his family has been farming. They're sheep herders, basically.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, they're in the Lake District in England. I know I'm really setting the hook here.
Yeah.
But he kind of walks through growing up in a beautiful place that people traveled to, but the local inhabitants aren't necessarily treated with respect a lot of the time. You know, that may be a stretch, but misunderstood may be the way that he would say it, and especially out of step with, you know, he was growing up in the 80s and 90s, out of step with what was happening in the rest of the UK and the rest of the world. His family's been there for generations and generations, and he ended up going to Oxford to go to college. So, you know, highly educated, but went back and now is living this shepherd's life.
How did you end up finding out about this book?
Matt Green recommended it to me. I think it's a great meditation on where you're from, the value in that, living locally in a very fast-moving world. And he's able to write about a beautiful place in a beautiful way and kind of do these little meditations as you go along. And it's also, I picked it up thinking that was going to be the heavy lifting, you know, some kind of, not philosophical, but definitely deep thinking about those ideas. But he also just talks a lot about sheep. So it was really interesting. This is one of my favorite books that I read this decade.
Is that a metaphor for something?
Maybe.
And the name of that one was what?
The Shepherd's Life.
Shepherd's Life by
James Rebanks.
What year was that released?
Came out in 2015.
Okay. No, it was not on my radar at all. Not that that says anything, but I'd never heard of it, though. All right. Well, so that's it. We've wrapped up all of our decade discussion, I think, with, you know, we did television a couple episodes back. We did movies in the last episode, and now music and books. So if anybody missed out, they can go back and listen. And if you feel like we left anything out, let us know. We'd be interested to find out. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back in a few minutes, and we'll get to talking about that Watchmen finale. People, if you're here and if you're listening, that means you've likely heard of The Alabama Take. The Alabama Take's a website with lots of thoughts and writing, but what else? It's also the name of our preeminent interview podcast hosted by our own Papa Bear, Corey Hanna. If you haven't already, go find it. Go find The Alabama Take and take your pick on various offerings. Corey has interviewed everyone from Jimbo Hart of the 400 Unit to John Paul White to his most recent one with comedian Cassio Mitchell. So go and listen. It's in a separate feed. You'll want to subscribe, like, rate, review, enjoy, and just have fun with that one. Also, drop us a line on social media. We've been hearing more and more people online getting in touch with us, and we want to send our heartwarming thank yous to those people. Shout out to Todd Aker and Chris Gray, who recently let me know that they were listening. We appreciate that. You can reach out to us on pretty much any social media feed except Snapchat. We are anti-Snapchat. We're not anti. We just don't have one. So let us know how we're doing.
TikTok?
I don't. And I think that's where we're going to get our millions. Anyway, you can let us know how we're doing on what we're missing on Taking It Down. Get in touch with us. And as always, if you're not a subscriber to this podcast, we're absolutely free. There's no charge. We're easily found on any podcast app. Also, a quick note, we post timestamps. Don't forget about that. I mentioned that earlier. So if you're worried about spoilers or anything, you know, check the timestamp and don't get into that or skip over it. And we hope that helps. Let's get back into Taking It Down. Yes. Yeah, so should we be on TikTok? Is that?
I think people want to see. I think 2020 is the year of TikTok for the Alabama Take.
Huh. Okay. Like,
which means that the youths are rapidly leaving TikTok. If we're finally picking it up, right?
I think that's how we turn our podcast into a cash grab. As we go to TikTok, is all right. So you and I are going to give some final thoughts on Watchmen. Hopefully this allows everybody to kind of get caught up on Watchmen in case they were a little behind. But Watchmen on HBO, created by Damon Lindelof, starring Regina King and Don Johnson briefly. And, you know, Lindelof, the creator and the writer, showrunner, has become sort of the epitome of wrapping up shows for good or for bad. Like he's the elf on the shelf, if you let me use that. Lost had a stupid ending from what I've gathered, and The Leftovers had just a beautiful, perfect lyrical finish.
That was so brutal. That was so brutal.
Well, it was brutal.
I just thought that was Lost had a stupid ending.
It had a stupid ending. Like, I watched
almost gathered, because that means you didn't even make it to the end.
No, and I'm glad I didn't, because I'd be pissed off. Yeah. So I watched that first season, and then I've said this before on the pod, so forgive me for repetition, but I watched that first season, pretty much all of it, and I started figuring out that some of the questions that were brought up in the first season of Lost were never intended to be answered, which frustrated the hell out of me at the time. I was that kind of television watcher, and so I kind of had picked it up on Netflix or whatever, some kind of streaming service, and I was behind. I didn't quite catch it when it was actually airing on ABC, and I started uncovering that they weren't going to answer some of these goddamn questions that they were bringing up.
Not even interested in trying.
Uh-uh. Like, let's just, and it felt so much like, let's just put a snowman, or let's put a Sasquatch on the island, and we won't have to explain that ever.
Right.
And to me, that just sounded so frustrating. And then I found out what the ending was. I didn't watch it. I did read about it in pretty detailed excerpts. And stupid.
Stupid. I don't disagree. I just thought you're coming out hot.
Yeah. Well,
so maybe he has learned his lesson, old Damon.
That brings me to The Leftovers, because I thought that was fantastic. I couldn't imagine a better ending. And I was just going to toss to you how you felt about the conclusion of Watchmen, which aired a couple weeks ago.
I feel like this nailed the landing more than any show in recent memory.
See, that's the way I felt. That's the way I felt, too.
And I don't really care if there's a season two in terms of like, I don't care if this is a season finale or a series finale. You know, it works as either. I hope that there's a season two if the same people are involved, because this was, I don't know if I saw a better show this year. So I would love to watch more, but man, what a program, what an ending.
Yeah, I ranked it as number two for the year, and you can go online and read that. Little quick plug. You can go read that list, but there's a reason why I gave another show number one over Watchmen, though it was barely. There were some people, I saw a little chatter online about the ending, and they said that they were very happy about it, but there was a few people also saying that they left them with questions, and I sent you a text message that said, how could that be? Are they misreading something? Did you think there was any kind of possibility to misread any of those scenes that ended the show?
I don't think so. I think they answered all of the questions that they set out to answer. You know, everything that was asked throughout the season. Maybe there's other wormholes that are opened that maybe people want to go down, but that's not the same as leaving things unanswered.
I agree. Which was an impressive feat because there were a lot of questions hanging in the air, even up to the penultimate episode. There were some things where I was thinking, could they wrap it up successfully? So,
well, and it took the final episode to finally understand how all of these different plot lines and characters all fit into the same program. You know, they started worlds apart, literally worlds apart, and just get closer and closer. I mean, it wasn't like small reveals. It's like there are big pieces of the puzzle that I had no idea where they were going to land going into the end here. Because the plans, you know, the show seems to be divided into the very, you know, it starts and it seems like a cops versus bad guys kind of thing. And then you start thinking, well, are the cops the good guys? And then it just kind of spirals from there to just multiple levels of conflict going on. So by the end, you have no idea, you know?
It was pretty bifurcated. Is that the right word? Where it had Ozymandias on literally on another planet and or another moon. And then they had the action. They never brought those two together until the final episode or two. Maybe the final two episodes, and I kept wondering if that was going to be the turbulence in the trip.
Right, that could have been it, or the.
But it wasn't
right, and the 7th Cavalry could have also been the turbulence. Well, how are they going to respond to Lady True, or is Lady True trying to do something good? You don't really know who's the good guy and who's the bad guy.
Right,
outside of Angela. Really? Uh-huh. Who you're just rooting for? I mean, who knows what... She seemed consistently like... I mean, she was the good guy the whole time. She's the one traversing the landscape.
Very much an audience point of view character and...
Right.
And sort of questioning everything she saw. But yeah, you're right. There was no question... no question that she was going to be the protagonist, I think.
I think what's remarkable about the ending, it could have been so reliant on, you know, the science fiction thing where you kind of just invent some rules about how these highfalutin ideas work to move your narrative, you know, and it didn't do that. It wasn't like, well, here's some like scientific reason that this didn't work. It all just like kind of clicked into place. The way that Lady True defeats old Bob, I refuse to assume that that is not Bob from
Senator Keene is his name on the show, but yeah, Bob from Mad Men, of course, as we lovingly know him.
Right, accounts man looks pretty good with his shirt off. I gotta say, it turns out Bob was working out that whole time. Everybody else was drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes.
I suppose when you're on a cruise with an elderly mother, then you get a chance to do some push-ups.
Yeah, you just hit the gym every day. Yeah,
tie it back to Mad Men there. But yeah, so it could have fallen prey to trying to be all science fiction-esque, right? But you're saying it avoided that a little, or
it didn't? Avoided that for the whole premise to be they're going to take this scientifically accidentally created Superman and try to steal his powers through these weird, you know, there was teleportation happening and different levels of gathering Manhattan's powers. Like, there's a lot of science-y stuff, you know, I'm putting air quotes around that.
Yeah.
That they could have decided what the plot was going to be and then used that to move from plot point to plot point. But it didn't happen. It still stayed very human the whole time.
Do you feel like it dropped the theme, any of its themes that it initially proposed in the first three or four episodes? Do you think it dropped those mistakenly or mishandled any of them?
Well, I thought the when Lady True is giving the speech to the, I guess, the leadership of this white supremacist organization that stretches back to the early 20th century, even when she did kill them all, she evaporated them all, right? That was the how that went down, I guess, would be the verb there. You're still kind of trying to figure out, she's doing this thing, but is she the good guy? I don't think she's the good guy. You know, like, evil was defeated, but the first evil didn't turn out to be the last evil.
Right, exactly. And there are levels of evil. And I think that's a very 2018, 2019 thing, where there's bad, and then there's worse, and then there's worse than that. I'm not
right. It makes you question, is the enemy of my enemy my friend?
Yep.
Well, not always. Sometimes. I mean, the outcome worked out for maybe what Will Reeves initially set out to do, but I don't know that that would be his chosen method to get there.
That's true. What do you think was the most fascinating theme the show explored? Because it was pretty weighty for a superhero show, so to speak.
I think it stuck with, no matter what the particulars were, it stayed with the idea of inherited trauma, both culturally and personally. I think that, you know, starting it in the Greenwood District with the race massacre, that lays out the premise of the show, the I guess crucial statement of trying to work through that kind of history. And it takes it down to the personal level, where there are actual survivors sharing their experiences, like Will to Angela. But then that's also reflected in Lady True, who comes from Vietnam, in this alternate history where Dr. Manhattan wins the war in Vietnam. Well, what does that mean? It means that a lot of Vietnamese died by Dr. Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Again, all of that stuff is kind of thrown up in the air. And you can't really... Lady True, obviously, kind of an evil mastermind like Ozymandias, but do they not both have their moments of trying to do what might be the objective black and white right thing?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. And it's a good show that offers up that kind of question and doesn't answer, rather than a narrative plot kind of question,
right,
and doesn't,
right,
answer. One thing that I think it opened my eyes to, and good art should do this kind of thing, is as a straight white male, I don't know that I had a very good sense, a grasp of inherited trauma. And it's not even anything I'd really thought a lot about in depth, I don't think. And that, how trauma can be passed down 80 years later, even, or 100 years after the fact. So it opened my eyes to that kind of topic that I'd never thought too hard on.
And it never, to me, beat you over the head with that idea. It made you,
nope,
feel it instead.
Exactly. And it's an excellent show. Really good. So what does a show like this do for you? Where does it scratch you, where you itch, pop culturally speaking? I'll rephrase it. What do you say to someone who's weary of like HBO shows or popular shows or even like superhero genre? What do you tell them?
Basically what we just said, and I've used that to try to convince people who maybe wouldn't usually go for the quote-unquote superhero show. You kind of have to explain, especially if they're not super familiar with the Watchmen idea, that they're kind of just using that as a vehicle to make these bigger points. Even, I mean, that's what the novel starts as, or the comic book. To me, this was the... Talk about using something as a vehicle. I mean, this feels like addressing the most important questions of 2019 America.
I don't think this show would have worked in the 90s if it was able to be made. I don't
know. No, and I don't think so. Even during like the Obama presidency, I don't think it works.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, not to get overly political but I mean, the show invites it for sure. In an era where you could make the argument, I think very successfully, that we have the president and a lot of the elected officials that we have as backlash against the first black president.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
For this show in a really profound way, and the way that they were able to bring nuance to a pretty wide range of characters. I mean, they're all of the white people aren't white supremacists, and all of the, you know, not everybody is not good or bad. There's equal representation across the board, I thought.
Like, I think you're right. Yeah. So it was the show of the year for you. Any other shows that you want to shout out that you just thoroughly enjoyed this year? You know, I've mentioned that my top 10's online now. It's on the website that people can go and check out. Do you have any that you wanted to recommend or
I'll give you three that I've really enjoyed recently. Yeah. Just sure. off the cuff, so to speak. I think The End of the Fucking World.
Yeah, was great. Good one.
The second season of that. I know we talked about that a little bit already. I think season 3 of The Crown, Netflix's program, is really good. It does some pretty introspective stuff, and it makes you, it is kind of always made the royals sympathetic figures, which I'm not really sure how they pull that off, because then I'd zoom out and I'm like, wait, I don't, you know, why do I feel bad for this person?
Yeah. Is that their best season? I don't watch The Crown. Is that their best season so far, though?
I don't, it's been a while since I've seen. You know, we've watched them as they came out, so it's been a few years. I remember being impressed with all of the seasons. This one, you have a lot of people hitting middle age. You know, they even switched actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they did that really well. And there's just a lot of questions about identity and self-worth. And there's coming-of-age elements, too, as the, you know, Elizabeth's children are now kind of college-aged that season. And they're, you know, products of the 60s and 70s kind of colliding with this very old institution of the monarchy. Interesting program.
Yeah. So what's the third?
Well, the third, I'll end on a light note. We have been binging the last season, the most recent, I should say. They're going to do this show forever. Season 34 of The Challenge.
Okay.
I think the show has hit new heights, and I was already a huge fan, and we were on the road so much in the fall that I missed it as it was happening. Listen, I'm here to tell you, take all your Shakespeare's and your great writings and history, your great dramas, throw them all in the trash can and go and find season 34 of The Challenge.
What, who's left on that show that I would maybe recognize from watching it? 12 years ago.
CT. Do you recall CT?
Vaguely.
You know, he was always the super Boston aggro dude.
But yeah, always Boston with
like
guy.
Kind of a conflicted soft side. And now it's funny as these guys get older and they keep getting in, like, you know, young 20-something kind of fresh faces and keeping these guys around much longer than they should be on reality TV on MTV.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, CT has a kid and like a pretty big gut at this point, but he's still like kind of this mountain of muscle that nobody really wants to mess with. It's just a funny collision of, for him in particular, like, you know, youthful bullshit going on in the corner. And he's just kind of sitting there just like, I just want some money, you know, and I like hitting people. So here we are.
Wow.
But him and Johnny Bananas was the face of the franchise for a long time.
Johnny Bananas.
Yeah, that's how he prefers to be known.
I don't think I know him.
His foil is eternally the ginger gentleman, Wes. Yeah, they're really, you know, there was kind of the original guard of this program, and then kind of a middle section where these guys came from. And there's still a few sticking around. They've started incorporating, this season is set up, so they... MTV, I guess, has sister programs in the UK, this whole reality system. And they start drawing people from that world into the challenge world. And Americans, too, from, you know, they don't do road rules, obviously, anymore. And I haven't seen a real world in a long time either.
Yeah, me either.
But they're still finding ways to get people new faces. So enough so that this year the setup was Team USA versus Team UK. Incredible program.
teens, but yet one of them is the CJ Boston guy.
Team USA, not Teen USA.
Oh, I thought you said like teenagers. Okay, well, there you go.
It would be very funny to watch one where he's just beating the shit out of a bunch of teenagers. I'd watch that.
I was going to say, I might have to tune in. I might have to find that one. All right, so there you go. So your three recommendations from this year.
I don't know if I would go, those are my recommendations from this year, but recency bias, those are three programs that I've enjoyed a lot this fall.
Oh, come on. Those are the best, right?
Oh, I'll always stand up for the challenge.
In fact, you've written about it on the site. If anyone wants to look that up. Yeah, it's a pretty good document of how you felt about it or still feel about it. All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up. That's all we've got for this podcast. It was plenty, I hope. We want to thank everybody for joining us on Taking It Down. Subscribe to our podcast. Review it. Give us some of them stars. And visit the website that started it all, thealabamatake.com. We will be back in 2 weeks. I don't know what we'll be talking about. We'll figure all that out later. You can join us and drop us a line online. We'll see you later. Later, mis amigos.
See you next year.
That's right. See you next decade even. And that's it. See you.